Chapter 1, and I don't know how you look out at the world in which we live. Are you an optimist or are you a pessimist? An optimist believes that this is the best of all possible worlds. A pessimist agrees that this is as good as it gets. So I don't know whether you're an optimist or a pessimist. I think the Apostle Paul is both, don't you? He is pessimistic about mankind. He is despairing of mankind, but he is trusting in God. It's the old good news, bad news routine, isn't it, that we've got here in Romans chapter 1. You know, I've got good news and I've got bad news for you. Which do you want to hear first, says the doctor to the patient. Give me the good news, says the patient. Okay, the doctor says, the good news is that they're naming a disease after you. Well, there's good news and there's bad news here in Romans chapter 1. We looked at the good news last week, and we'll come back to it again this morning in verse 17. The gospel is the power of God unto salvation to everyone who believes. And in the gospel, there is a righteousness from God. It's not our own righteousness that we have to put together ourselves. It is God's righteousness that is given to us as a gift. The way to get right with God is a gift from God through Jesus and his death on the cross. And that's great news. There's no better news than that. But now Paul is going to tell us why we need to hear that news, why he's so eager to go to Rome, which is the capital of the world. It is the world city of the day, and why he is so eager to get there with this good news of the gospel. Because, he says, and there's a connecting word in the original language here, which isn't in the NIV, but the reason he's so eager to go and preach the gospel in Rome is because, verse 18, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven. God is angry with this world. God is angry with human beings. He's furious with us. Martin Lloyd-Jones wrote a book on this chapter, and he called it The Plight of Man and the Power of God. And those are my two headings for this morning. The Plight of Man, and unfortunately we're going to spend a lot of time in that first point, and the Power of God. So first of all, let's start with the plight of man. Look at verses 29 to 32. I'm going to read a paraphrase of those verses, but it's amazingly up-to-date, isn't it, this paragraph? Paul is writing in the first century about Rome, but this could be a page from the Courier or from any Australian newspaper. Here's Eugene Peterson's paraphrase of these verses, 29 to 32. Rampant evil, grabbing and grasping, vicious backstabbing. They make life hell on earth with envy, wanton killing, bickering and cheating. Look at them, mean-spirited, venomous, fork-tongued, God-bashers, bullies, swaggerers, insufferable windbags. They keep inventing new ways of wrecking lives. They ditch their parents when they get in the way. Stupid, slimy, cruel, cold-blooded. It's not as if they don't know better. They know perfectly well they're spitting in God's face and they don't care. Worse, they hand out prizes to those who do the worst things best. Not a very flattering picture, is it? And Paul is describing his own world, the world in which he lives, but you see how remarkably similar it is. You just look at your television guide for this week and you'll see all those things on television this week. This is what happens when people turn their back on God. It's a world, it's a state of moral decay. And it doesn't matter whether it's first century Rome. You know, when Rome eventually fell to the barbarian hordes in the 4th century AD, it wasn't because that the opposing armies were militarily superior. It was because the Roman Empire, you read the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, Gibbons's decline and fall of the Roman Empire, you'll find that it was because the empire had become so morally flabby and internally weak, they were a pushover with no will to fight, with nothing to defend save personal pleasure and certainly no principle. And they're not the first civilization to go that way. That's where we're going right now. They won't be the last. So this is our world that he's describing here, not just as much as it was Nero's world in the first century AD, at the beginning of the fall of the Roman Empire. And just as much, for that matter, as it was Noah's world at the time of the flood, when we're told that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. Human nature doesn't change. We're not evolving towards some perfect society. We're not heading for utopia. Paul is describing here what happened in the garden, when Adam and Eve rebelled against God and decided that they could be gods themselves. He's describing life in a fallen world. This is what it looks like. But you see, what we have here is not simply a description. It's a diagnosis. If you look at these words carefully, this passage carefully, see, there are no shortage of people who will tell you what's wrong with the world today. There was a very entertaining program on the telly called Grumpy Old Men. And I think there's a feminine version of it as well, where various celebrities kind of air their views on this subject. And it can be very entertaining. Well, Paul is not a grumpy old man. He's a gospel man, as we saw last week. And this is his diagnosis. The reason the world is in the mess that it is, he says in verse 18, is because God is angry with us. And that's not some threat in the far distant future. He's angry right now. The wrath of God, God's anger, is being revealed right now in the things that are happening in our society, in the things that are happening in our own lives. And look what it says there. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of people. And let me say, that's not an oxymoron. Paul is not using two words when one will do. Godlessness and wickedness are not the same thing. The one leads to the other. Godlessness leads to wickedness. I don't know if you ever tried that trick. Thankfully, the children have gone out to Sunday school, so I'm not going to be putting dangerous ideas into their heads. But do you ever remember as a kid that trick when people used to whip the tablecloth out from underneath a fully laid table? Don't try that at home. You get a lot of broken crockery if you try to do that, unless you're an expert, of course. And isn't it true that so many people seem to think that you can do that with God? You can whisk away the living God and things will be just the same. You can still have Christian values. You can still have ethical standards. You just whisk away the tablecloth and, well, what happens, of course, you don't get broken crockery. You get broken lives. You get havoc and destruction. That's what Paul is saying here. God is not amused. He's furious. That's our problem. Not lack of education, or the need for more technology, or better housing. The problem, Paul says, is that we're on the wrong side of God. God is angry. And there's no excuse for it. You see, you may plead ignorance. Perhaps I don't know who's here this morning. Maybe you're not yet a Christian, or you're checking out Christianity, or somebody's invited you along. And perhaps you'd say, well, look, I keep an open mind about this. I'm an agnostic. You're an ignoramus, because that's what the word means. I don't want to insult you, but literally that's what the word means. It means you don't know. Thomas Huxley coined the word at the end of the 19th century. Engels accused Huxley of being a closet atheist who didn't have the courage to come out and say there's no God. See, maybe that's where you are. You're not, put me down as a don't know. But see, Paul's point here is this: you should know. You should know. When it comes to the existence of God, ignorance is no excuse. That's what he's saying. And I don't speak Swahili. I do speak a bit of Welsh, but I was born in Wales, and I'm married to a Welsh-speaking wife with Welsh-speaking children. So I should speak a bit of Welsh, probably a lot more Welsh than I actually do. I haven't applied myself to it as I should. But I don't speak Swahili. I wasn't born in South Africa. And I don't feel guilty about not speaking Swahili. I can hardly be blamed for that. But you see, if I take a car out onto the road and knock someone down, I can hardly plead ignorance of the highway code, can I? As an excuse. If I don't know the highway code, then that makes me more guilty if I'm taking a car out onto the road. It doesn't extenuate my guilt. My ignorance of the highway code doesn't extenuate. It exacerbates my guilt, doesn't it? If I'm taking a car on the road, I need to know how to drive it. My ignorance of the highway code is culpable ignorance. And that's what Paul is saying here about God. We live in God's world. We have been made by God, and we have been made for God. It's not that we don't know. We don't want to know. As someone has said, the real history of this world is not, as they teach in school, the real history of this world is not that there is no God and we persuaded ourselves that there is. That's how they teach religion in schools. It's comparative religions, and this is mankind trying to make sense of the world we're living in. There's no God, we just made it up because we needed a God figure. No, that's not the real history of this world. The real history of this world is that there is a God and we have persuaded ourselves that there's not. That's what Paul is arguing here, do you see? Look what he says there in verse 18. We suppress the truth. I remember at Heathrow Airport once seeing a very large West Indian lady sitting on her suitcase. She'd come through customs and they'd emptied her suitcase of all her belongings, and now she'd put it all back again and she was sitting on the lid trying to get it closed. That's the picture here, Paul says. It's not that we don't know the truth, but we suppress it. We put the lid on it. Look at verses 19 to 20. What may be known about God is plain, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. You go across the river to the Queensland Art Gallery and you view some of the paintings there. You wouldn't think, depends which gallery you go to, I suppose, but you wouldn't think for one moment that those works of art just came into being by themselves. If you go to the Gallery of Modern Art, you might think that. But if you're into art, you'll stand there and you'll look at it and you'll try and appreciate what's there on the canvas in front of you. And as you study the painting, part of your mind will ponder the artist himself, maybe thinking, what an incredible imagination that artist has. I would never have seen things like that. It's not a photograph. There's something in this painting, which I would never have seen if the artist hadn't used his imagination. What a skill to be able to transfer those thoughts via brushstrokes and pigments onto canvas. Isn't that what you do when you go to an art gallery? Well, open your eyes, Paul says. Similarly, God has taken steps to make himself known through what he has made. God is an artist. God's made this amazing world in which we live. I just saw one of the latest pictures from the Hubble telescope just yesterday. This is an amazing universe that we live in. God himself is invisible and eternal, but through what can be seen in space and time, he communicates to us something of his divine nature, his divine artistry, if you like. And what's more, there is within each one of us, according to verse 21, a knowledge of God. Perhaps more of a sense of God, an intuitive knowledge, if you like, an awareness deep down that there is someone who has made us, someone to whom we are accountable. And all of us knows far more than we're letting on. We have the truth. But what do we do with it? We suppress it. We push this knowledge below the level of consciousness in order to escape its disturbing claims. It's not that we don't know, we just don't want to know. Every one of us knows far more than we're willing to admit. Remember that when you're trying to witness to people. Remember that. You don't have to convince them. They already know. They won't admit it, but they already know the truth. And that, you see, this has consequences for us intellectually. See what it says there in verse 21. Our thinking has become darkened. Instead of being wise, we become fools, Paul says. Take the philosopher Bertrand Russell, one of the greatest atheist philosophers of the 20th century. He was a genius. But he left his family destroyed, his followers disillusioned as he lied and cheated his way through one affair after another. How foolish can you get? We're often fed the view that the great thinkers who have shaped the modern world in its rejection of Christianity and the Christian heritage have done so as a result of detached intellectual wrestling. That's not true. So as a matter of intellectual integrity, the old order had to be overthrown. No, not at all. Nothing could be further from the truth. Look at verse 24. It's not intellectual integrity that rules us. See what he says there in verse 24? It is the sinful desires of our hearts. In his book, Intellectuals, Paul Johnson has shown that whether it's Rousseau and his concern for individual freedom, or Karl Marx and his alleged concern for the workers, deep down, they were driven by what can only be described as egocentric desires. The impulses came first, and then some form of justification of their ideas came second. You can see that over and over again. It's a great book to read, Paul Johnson's book, The Intellectuals. He just demonstrates that over and over again from the lives of these people who have shaped our modern world. Let me give you just one example. This is quite a controversial example, but let me give you just one example of someone who's changed the West's outlook on sex, and especially homosexuality, more than anybody else. The American zoologist Alfred Kinsey, who in 1948 and 1953 produced two very influential reports, which, amongst other things, claimed that 10% of the male population were predominantly homosexual. And that's a figure that's often quoted. Did Kinsey pursue his studies with scientific detachment, with no axe to grind? Not at all. According to his biographer, James Jones, Kinsey himself was both homosexual and a sadomasochist who encouraged his research team to have sex with each other and his wife while he filmed them in their attic. He also fixed his research results to support his lifestyle. Far from taking representative samples from the male population at large to determine sexual orientation and practice, 26% of his subjects were sex offenders. A further 25% were in prison. The rest were male prostitutes and pimps. Worse still is the more recent evidence that he employed and trained pedophiles. And this work, this research, provided much of the basis for the loosening of society's attitudes towards sexual activity from the 1960s to the present day. Do you see? Do you see what was driving this scientific research? Certainly not the pursuit of objective truth, but sadly his own lusts. Sex had become his idol. There are intellectual consequences, and there are spiritual consequences too. We persuaded ourselves that there's no God, and so we have to put something else in his place. Look at verse 23. They exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man. This is what we do. You see, we remake God in our own image. We reimagine God to suit ourselves. So he's a God who let us get away with whatever we want to do. That's idolatry. And here we are then at the beginning, you see, of the 21st century. And has there ever been a century so steeped in superstition as ours? I mean, I remember even in my own lifetime, people were saying, oh, you know, the old superstitions have passed, the age of Christianity is over, and so on. Now science has come into its own, and so on. And yet, intelligent people still believe that the way you organize your furniture actually affects your well-being, and that crystals have healing powers, and all that sort of stuff. And we're told, aren't we, it doesn't matter what you believe, as long as you get through life. If you believe in God, well, that's okay for you, and that helps you, but it's no different from someone who believes in the blue fairy or something else. No wonder God is angry with us. Hasn't he got the right to be angry? Doesn't it make you angry when you hear this sort of stuff? Not that God flies off the handle. Not that God loses his temper or anything like that. God's anger is his settled disposition, his hatred of everything that is contrary to his nature and his character. And there's a very high price to pay then, not only intellectually but spiritually, but as we see in this passage, socially. So we look at verse 24 and following, the result of all this is the disintegration of the social order. That's why it's happening. It's what happens when people turn away from God. Three times Paul uses a phrase here which should chill us to the bone. He's three times in verse 24, in verse 26, and in verse 29, Paul speaks about God giving us over. That's what's happening in Australia today. It's the worst thing that can happen to us. Oscar Wilde, who was no friend of Christianity, Oscar Wilde sums it up very well. He says, when the gods wish to punish us, they answer our prayers. That's the worst thing that could happen. When God is angry with us, when we are rebelling against him, the worst thing is for him just to give us what we want, isn't it? And God says to us, all right, do it your own way. See how that turns out for you. Look at verse 28. Eugene Peterson paraphrases it like this. Since they didn't bother to acknowledge God, God quit bothering them and let them run loose, with devastating consequences. And it's not just homosexuality that Paul mentions here. He does mention homosexuality very clearly. And he mentions it first, not because it's a worse sin than any of the other things that are in this list. And I wouldn't think, if anyone is here this morning struggling with same-sex attraction and wanting to know about what the Bible has to say about that, I don't want you to hear that homosexuality is some kind of unforgivable sin. It's just one symptom. It's just as bad as gossip and envy and greed and deceit and all these other things that are mentioned here. But it's a description of what happens when we go against the created order. It's a description of a dysfunctional society in which we live. See, the trouble is we sometimes come to a passage like this and we see what Paul has to say here about homosexuality in the Roman Empire, and then we immediately feel better about ourselves, don't we? It's the tabloid mentality, you know. We love to read about the bad behavior of other people because it makes us feel better about ourselves. But you read the whole passage, and you'll find yourself in this passage. This is us we're talking about. Look at verse 29. They become filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, and depravity. They're full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, and malice. They are gossips, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, arrogant, and boastful. They invent ways of doing evil. They disobey their parents. They have no understanding, no fidelity, no love, no mercy. That's true of any church I've been in. Sad to say. It's human nature. This is what we're like. And although they know God's righteous decree that those who do such things deserve death, Paul says, they not only continue to do these very things, but also approve of those who practice them. This is the judgment of God upon us. He gives us what we want. He gives us over. He abandons us to our lusts. And he does so, listen to me carefully now at this point, he does so because he loves us. God's anger and his love are not incompatible. You know that if you're a parent. Why do you get angry with your kids sometimes? It's because you love them, isn't it? And you want the best for them. The reason God is so angry with us every day is because he loves us. And in his loving anger, he gives us over to the consequences of our sin. Sometimes that's the only thing to do, isn't it? When people are hell-bent on destroying themselves, you can't help them until they stop fighting you. Apparently, so I'm told, if you're a lifesaver, the best thing to do is to leave a person in the water long enough until they're exhausted. Otherwise, they're likely to wrap themselves around you and drown you as well. And God does that. God waits. You read the history of this world. God waits to be gracious. You can see that again and again in the history of this world. He waits for us to come to the end of ourselves before he steps in to rescue us. He's not indifferent to our sin and rebellion. He absolutely hates it, but he loves us, and so he leaves us in our sin to come to our senses. Martin Lloyd-Jones, he was a big influence on me. Before he became a preacher of the gospel in London, in Westminster Chapel in the heart of London, he was a Harley Street specialist. He was assistant to Lord Hoarder, the royal physician. He argues from his background in medicine that it is very bad practice to try and alleviate the symptoms of an ill patient straight away. Those symptoms, the spots, the aching joints or whatever, are often the best indicators that you have to help you diagnose the real underlying problem. And of course, that's what you really want to treat, not the symptoms, but what's causing the symptoms. And what we've got here are the symptoms. And God, because he loves us, he allows those symptoms to run their course in order to bring us to our senses and make us realize that our world is spiritually sick and we need healing. We desperately need help from outside of ourselves. And that's where the good news comes in, doesn't it? That's why Paul is so eager to go to Rome. Not to improve their housing, not to give them better schools, not to teach Christian values in the Roman society, but to preach the gospel. Because in the gospel there is a righteousness from God, a righteousness that God gives us. It's the righteousness that's lived out in the life of Christ. He lived that life that we should have lived, and he died the death that we deserve to die. In his active and passive obedience, God has provided a way of salvation for us. In the gospel, Paul says, is the power of God to salvation. It's a power outside of ourselves. We can't lift ourselves up by our own bootlaces. We need help from outside of ourselves. And in the gospel, there is a power from God unto salvation for everyone who believes. That's why Paul writes this letter. That's why he wants to go to Spain, not as a sightseer, but as a soul winner. That's why he's writing to this city, which is so well known in the history of the world. He's writing to a bunch of people just like us. People who fit into all the categories described here in this paragraph. Those who've lived the high life, sleeping around, who swindled and lied and cheated their way through life, who've broken their parents' hearts by the way they've trampled over their feelings. People just like us. You see, sometimes people think, oh, to be a Christian means you're a nice person. If I say to you, are you a Christian, you're insulted because you think I'm kind of questioning whether you're a nice person or not, or a respectable. No, no, my friends, Christianity is for nasty people, not for nice people. You're nasty people. So am I. I'm a nasty person. I need saving. I need rescuing. God's angry with me. Do you see? And that's why Paul is so keen to get this message out into the world, because in the gospel there's a way for me to get right with God. And it's for everyone who believes. You have to believe it in order to receive it. Let me finish with this story. George Wilson was a criminal a couple of centuries ago in America. He was convicted of robbery with violence and sentenced to death. President Andrew Jackson granted him a pardon, but he refused it. The matter went to the Supreme Court, and they produced this statement. Listen carefully to this statement. I think it's it's helpful. A pardon is a deed to the validity of which delivery is essential. Delivery is not complete without acceptance. It may be rejected. If rejected, we, the Supreme Court, have discovered no power in court to enforce the pardon. It may be supposed that nobody being condemned to death would reject a pardon, but if they do, the rule must be the same. George Wilson was too proud to receive that pardon, and he was executed. My friends, what about you? The good news, the unimaginable good news, that this holy God has found a way for us to be saved, to be rescued, to be put right with him. The unimaginably good news is that there is a pardon from God, a free pardon for all our sin and our rebellion. And God holds it out, no strings attached to us. All we have to do is receive it by believing in Jesus, by trusting in his Son. Tragically, many refuse to do so. Calling me a sinner, many people are too proud to admit that they need such a pardon. But the vilest offender who truly believes that moment from Jesus, a pardon receives. Let's pray. Our Lord and our God, we pray that everyone who's weary and heavy laden, in need of rest, in need of forgiveness, sensing their sin, sensing your wrath, that they would come to Christ today, wherever the gospel is preached, anywhere in this city, anywhere in this world, and trust in him for their salvation, and believe on him and commit themselves to him, to live by him. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.